And you knew who your partner was going to be for the whole evening, you know. You could have them all engaged up. So when they say, get your partners for the waltz, so-and-so, well, she'd be waiting for you. And, but now they don't do anything like that. And we used to go, we used to be polite with people. You know, I think it was nice. You'd go to an older girl, if you didn't have this date set to go, and you'd walk up to her and speak to her and say, would you like to have this dance with me? And I like, but today they go over and grab them by the arm and pull them onto the floor and don't ask them if they want to dance or anything. And to me, they don't dance anymore anyway. They all they do is get, they aren't together hardly at all, dance back and forth by themselves and jig and dance and hop around. To me, that's not a dance. And I love a good waltz. You get a good partner that's got a smooth waltz and that like, you have to turn the light down low and boy, that's a dancing.
Were there callers?
Oh yeah,
dancing?
Yeah.
Who were the best callers?
Well, when I was young, you know, I hope I can think of his name. He was worked for Plain Parker. Mainland Shattuck was a wonderful caller, short, chunky man. But he knew the call. He didn't have to have a book or anything. He could call for any square dance or anything like that. And I'm telling you, they had to dance according to the music. They didn't get to pick up to rough it in like you do sometimes, eight hands around and going round and round and tearing and swinging. Boy, he'd motion for the orchestra to stop. And he'd tell those people in that set or that or that, do you folks want to dance or do you just want to raise hell? If you're going to raise hell, you'll go out of the hall and do it. But while you're in here dancing, you stay with the music, or else you don't dance here anymore. Well, you know, they were no more of that tearing around and yelling and laughing and yanking people around. They had to dance right by the music. He was wonderful. And then later on, to those kitchen junkets, David McNeil from Canada lived up to East Warren. He was a good little caller. And then, of course, there was another one that used to call a lot, Riley Moulton from down in Waitsfield. He was great. He was funny as a crutch. He'd say some funny things, but he was good.
Do you remember any of his calls?
Oh, gosh. He used to call, of course, for Portland Pants and Fisher's Hornpipe and all those old-fashioned ones and Portland Pants and Cadrilles. And I know he always used to sing out the one there was, walk right back in the same old track and swing with the girl behind you. Pass right through, two and two, and swing with the girl behind you. When he gets through, he'd say, swing your partner, I don't care. Take her wherever you want, it's all over.
And then I heard that Casey Jones came from the Midwest, I guess, and introduced a different style of calling.
Well, I never knew him. No.
He, I guess, was Elvin Jones's father, wasn't he? One that made the snowblower?
No. Because his father never, I don't think he ever went to dances, or if he did, he No. I can't think what his name was. And because when they moved from Colorado, bought Edgar Town Farm up there by the South Schoolhouse, we went over and Dad and people years ago, my folk did anyway, and a lot of the ones, the only ones, anybody move into town, strangers, after they got settled, they'd go and call on them, welcome them. So we went over and welcomed the Joneses, come from Colorado. And he brought with him a wonderful cow dog, or hog dog. She was a English Shepherd, natural born bobtail English Shepherd. And he brought this little puppy along to keep her company. And so then I was young, and Clarin, my brother Clarin was there, 4 years older. We wanted that puppy, so Dad's said he wanted to know. He said, I just brought it along to keep him mother company coming, had come by train, you know, from Colorado. And so he said, the puppy's for sale. So Dad bought it because the other little dog was getting old, and she was the most wonderful kill dog. And the mother was out, he had her father, Jones had a hog ranch out there in Colorado. And these dogs are trained to round up hogs. And Mr. Jones told several times that he could take that mother and another one they had and go out into the pasture field while there was a bunch of hogs and point out a certain one that he wanted. And those two dogs would go down and circle and get that hog and get around to it. One of them would jump and grab one ear, and when he did, the other one would grab the other, and they'd hold that hog till they could go there and put some ropes on it and bring it in. And that puppy was the greatest. Well, she was born right in her. When we had her, she got grown up. And she'd be on the piazza in the summertime asleep when they're eating dinner or something, and a bunch of shorts down in the barn get the doors open, you know, and they get to fighting and squealing. Boy, will you hear lots of that dog hear some squealing. Boy, would she leave and run down the barn to see what's going on? And also, we used to round up wild cattle with her. Occasionally, people would have cattle turned out in the back pasture for the summer. They'd go once a week and give them a little salt, and sometimes the Jerseys, especially Jerseys. When fall come, they would be one, two of them a little shy, and we'd go there to salt them, but they wouldn't come in. The rest of them would stay away. Well, when come fall, try to catch them in, they'd be scared of people, and they would call wild heifers. And well, you can catch them with a rifle, in other words, you know, a lot of times, because you couldn't run them down or head them off. They'd ride through a fence or anything else. And many times we used to go take old Teddy and go and get that old dog, could get up far, he could see him, tell him to go get him. He'd go and get him. And he'd run, he could run faster they could, and I like, and he'd run up and get, and they'd turn around, and as soon as he got up far, he could, he'd jump and catch him by the ear or the neck or anywhere. And if he got a good hold of the neck, until he'd hang on, and that animal would whirl around, and he'd be just hanging with his teeth, and his feet not touching. But after about one turn, the animal was so scared with him hanging on there, they'd just stand there with their tongue out, and you could walk up and put a rope on him. And he would hang on until you got the rope on. And you'd get a rope on him, and that's the way we caught a lot of wild heifers with old Teddy. And he was some dog, and he came from Colorado, and we kept him, and well, a lot of neighbors bred to him. He raised up quite a lot of, and I've got a beautiful picture of him. It was his, not him, but his great-granddaughter.
Now, did you keep the breed?
Yeah, but of course he got run out because we didn't have another.
Yeah. Oh, he looks great.
That little dog that I had down on the farm, and I had her when I moved up here.
I'll be done.
And you know, she was still related. But I could go down in the barn in the fall, the barn to get the cows. They would be up nights in the field, foggy, and I like couldn't see a cow. And I'd go down there and start sweeping out the manger, and I'd say, Teddy, go get the cows. The time before I got the manger swept out, you know, you'd hear them hoof prints, them cows coming into the barn right in there. And she'd go around a whole bunch of them, bring them. And this was amusing, was if she had to make a second trip, she didn't like it. But she was careful with them. She'd drive them in so nice and easy, you know, wouldn't hurry them, circle back and forth. Come in the barn, and they'd all take their places, you know, in the stall. And it was 40, that's the last time I haven't had 20 cows on each side. She'd trot right down through, and if there was one missing, she'd look around, I'd say, Teddy, there's one lacking. She'd go back out that barn. Well, I didn't pay no attention to them. It was long before that cow came in. When that cow came in, she wasn't walking, she was trotting. She'd keep it right up behind and nabbing her heel, and she'd make that cow come back in the barn in a hurry.
Oh, that's funny.
So, she was quite a dog. So,
did a lot of people have cow dogs?
Yeah, most every farmer had a cow dog, yeah.
And they would train it?
Well, some of them did, some of them some of them didn't know how to train them and didn't train them, and the dog would go and kill dog. Some of them would go, and when you could send them to go and get a cow to go, all they do is go after its head or try to jump and get its ear or something and tear an ear out or something, you know. And that dog, you know, a kill dog, never want to go to the head of the cattle except when they were like wild and catch them, like that old Teddy did, the old original. But otherwise, when they're driving the cow, stay behind them and just nip their heels.
Now, did you train Teddy?
Yeah.
How'd you do that?
Oh, just with her when she was little.
Worked with her
with a little light clothesline, a little long line and string and bale of twine and stuff like that, you know. And here, take her in the cage, easy, and just snap her back if she was a little too rough, and not let her go up to the heels and that like. And I'm telling you, the cattle dealers like to come out and get a cow, you know, to come load into a truck. Back then they had, not trailer, but trucks, you know, back up. Some cows, a lot of time later on, they used electric prods to get them up in. They get on a rope and pull, and the cow didn't want to go up that around and put a pricker with an electric prod, you know, and that like. They never had to use it when they're down there. When they get ready to load a cow, it's, say, get up into the truck and tighten the rope, the cow will come in. And all this time, you know, Teddy would be right there with me. Whining, but I wouldn't say anything. She wouldn't do anything until I said, so when I got up to the gate and the cow didn't go up in there, all I had to do was just point my finger. She'd right up that cow and grab her by the heels, and I'm telling you, about the second time she grabbed hold of that cow's heel, that cow was, could see that ramp and right up in the truck. No hesitation. And so.
Well, would she sleep in the house with you?
Or? Yeah.
So she was a pet as well?
Oh, yes, yeah. And you know, when we come up here, this is a rug that my wife made, braided herself all out of new wool, bought new cloth, and braided it all by hand, and it's sewed, not just tied up.
Yeah.
And it's a reversible too, and it's pretty heavy. But she came when we moved up here. Well, down on the farm, same way. She never walked on that rug. And you know, when the grandchildren was here, they'd be in the other room play with her. She loved to play with the kids. She'd know she was a big dog. And they'd come out and they'd run across here, ground there. She'd follow them, you know, go after them. But she wouldn't go across here. She'd go out around that way and meet them. She never, and she'd lay down here and sleep right here, right side of this chair or something, right on the side of the rug, right on the edge right there. But she never walk on the rug.
Now, she was a daughter or a granddaughter?
Oh, way back, great-grand. Yeah. And not, I mean, a trainer and I like, but, you know, strangers come in, she might bark at somebody,
yeah.
But she wouldn't hurt anybody if they behaved themselves. But I could set her on to anybody. I don't care who thought. If I point my finger, I said, take him. I'm telling you, she'd take hold. And Gertrude, my wife, said she always, when she moved up here, said, I feel perfectly safe staying here with old Teddy. She said, nobody's going to hurt me. But she'd come in, she'd come around, and I'd say, lay down. She'd go back and lay down. You wouldn't see her again. She won't come around and bother anybody or anything else. She'd just sit right down and lay right down off herself. That was it. And I had a doghouse built in the corner for her. And when I moved up here from the farm, the neighbor says, well, I hope old Teddy don't get run over up here while the traffic is and that like, because she's been used to running all over that 240-acre farm. But she never went off the farm. She knew where the boundaries were. She'd never go off. And she'd go out hunt woodchuck all by herself around the walls and that like. And I said, oh, she wouldn't get run over. So when I moved up here, that fall, because it was in November when I moved, but next spring, we kept watching her. Next spring, I took her out and called her with me, and I showed her where the boundaries were. We walked around my boundary lines, the neighbor trash, that like, a couple of times. And when we're walking around, she'd go smelling around, you know, and if she went over the other side, I'd go, no, Teddy, you stay on this side.
And she was fine.
And she just went across the road. She didn't like to have other dogs. When they come up here, there's a lot of dogs every morning to come across the people that I bought out. And they had several neighbor dogs run all over the place, and I like. And, well, she didn't like him running around there. She'd chase him. And one day she chased one out across and went over the other side of the road, over across the highway and down over. And Gertrude hollered to him and said, "Titty gone." I went over and I scolded her a little bit. And sometime, I don't know, later she got after one and she went over and then she was smelling over the other side. So I tiptoed pretty spry up the barn and got my horse whip, long driving whip. And I went out there and she was still smelling around over the other side while the dogs had been. And the road built up and it drops over. She couldn't, and when I got over there about, I could see where she was and I got old age and she was smelling around. She didn't see me and I brought that whip around her once good in shape. And I said, "Teddy, you come home." Well, she come home. But from that time on, I'm telling you, you can ask my neighbors if it was here. She'd chase a dog out to that driveway, out to the road, and she'd stop. She never went in that road after that. And we used to go away, and Warren Thompson was a tenant here. He'd feed her for me if we was going to be gone. Gertrude and I had gone out to Pennsylvania something for 2-3 days. And I had him or somebody take care of the horse and feed Teddy. And she had her little house out here. Never hit her, not like go away. And she never went away. She'd stay there. And so you can teach them a lot if you work with them. And some are smart enough. She was a smart dog. And I'm telling you.
Well, I'm thinking about Warren. What are the biggest changes from your time there and now?
Well, of course, the biggest thing is a mill town, you might say, with all the mills and a lot of production made and shipping everything to Roxbury. And today, there's no mills there at all. Nothing there but just a store and post office about all it is, and the town hall and the church and the firehouse. But as far as I know, there's nothing being manufactured there. The only thing that Warren has got is that sugar bush ski area. And that's the making of Warren today, and that's why their taxes are real cheap there, because a lot of income from the property taxes of the sugar bush owning that property, not like. But there's no real business there in Warren that I know of. I don't know of anything that employs any help more than up to the ski business. There may be some, but I don't know. I'm not old enough, so I don't know. But the business, big business is. And another thing, the farms are all gone. When I was there, there was farms all over the place. And now there's only one farm in the town of Warren shipping milk. And that great big farm of Pearl Dental is where they used to milk 125 cows by hand. Barn 160 feet long, there's no barn. But some rich people bought a piece of land there and built a horse arena, indoor arena, big arena, and finished up with apartments so people could live in it, and a nice stable. And that is, nobody's using it now. But the old big barn is gone, and I don't know, the house is pretty well gone. But that was a big farm with 100 at that time, back in 1908, 910, 125 cow farm was a big farm.
Yeah.
And all done by hand, milked by hand. And
amazing.
And that like, and they had a big sugar place, and there were several big farms all out through Everett, from when you go rock around the Warren Four Corners, turn to the right to go to Waitsfield, every farm out through there had milk cows out through there. And but today there isn't any. It's all gone. There's a few, not too many, but a few farms that are still milking in Waitsfield, but somebody told me there was only about 8 or 9 farms in the town of Waitsfield that are shipping milk.
I think that's right.
But the priests are the only ones in the town of Warren that are shipping milk. That's up by the airport.
Yeah. I've talked with them.
Yeah.
And then Elwin Neal.
Yeah.
And George Carpenter.
Yeah.
I guess Howard Turner is still, does he still have a farm? Down toward Moortown.
Yeah, well, I didn't Howard.
Albert?
Albert. I should know what his name is because I'm his wife's uncle.
Oh, you are?
Marion is. I'm uncle to Marion. And his health ain't too good, but his son is operating there, doing quite a little farming right
now. Now, is Albert Howard's father?
I don't know what his father's name is. I did have forgotten. No, I don't know. All I know is Albert is the one that, and he had quite a few boys, and they're up off and been to school, mm-hmm. and some of them graduated from over here to VTC, and one of the boys is there living in a trailer right back and operating the farm with his father helping him. And then, of course, the Bisbys and all those people are still milking cows.
Well, Moortown was a different kind of farm, a different kind of town than Warren and Waitsfield.
Yeah.
Because it was owned by one family, so to speak.
Well, I don't know, it might have been way back, but it was more or less, well, I don't know what I want to say. I don't know too much about it. I don't know too much about it, but I know Moortown was a little different operation town. And of course Moortown has had quite a lot of lumber business for the Wards. Holly Ward owns a big lot of mill business there. And so I don't know too much about Moortown. All I know is a number of years ago was when I was selling farm machinery for Greenland. Farm up well away from Moortown Common there, it the only one that I knew of at that time was raising the Dutch Holstein and Dutch belted cows.
Yeah.
Now I can't remember his name, but it's up in Moortown Common. He raised those Dutch.
Yeah, it was the Austrian guy, Van Trapp.
I can't think of his name. I forgot. I've got so used to can't remember any names, as I've said before, but he was up there off on the side. We'd go up to Moortown Common and turn off to the right and go way up in there. And gosh, but he raised, I guess they still raise them up there. I think they do.
I'll be darned.
But there ain't many of those around.
No. Well, the other thing.
General Stores. John Spaulding had the biggest one, and then George Bragg had the other one. And then sometimes later, Warner Moore started into with a little cobbler business. And from that, he enlarged and he did repaired harnesses. And from that, he was a barber. And from that, he kept putting in groceries. And, well, I wish you could have had a picture of that store. Everything was wedged in here and there. You would walk into the place, you could hardly walk around in it because he was so crowded. And you wondered how that man knew where anything was, but you asked him about it, and he knew where it was. And, of course, it was quite a story. He was a big fella and kind of a nervous fella. But as I say, he'd repair harnesses and he'd do everything, tap his shoes and all that kind of stuff. And the funny thing was, this was told many times, he'd be working on a work harness or something, sewing up a work harness. Might have been, as they said, the britching or something, while the manure had been on it or something. Somebody come in, get in the barber chair, and they used to shave people. And now nobody shaves anybody anymore. I don't know why, but they don't. But everybody used to go in and get a shave. They said he'd stop fixing, working on the harness. He'd go over, never wash his hand, and then he'd go over and take his bowl and water and brush and put lather on his face and take his fingers and rub it into their whiskers and shave them. he had everything here later on in that store, dry goods and groceries and everything else. And one thing was kind of funny one time, what is her name? A woman, she was one of these women that you'd say different tone of voice, was always kind of a whiny voice, and always looking for something that you didn't have. And she came in there one day, and he was had so much on his mind, I don't wonder he was nervous. She came in there, and she was asking, and you'd think his store was a hardware store. He had log chains, canned dogs, forks, hoes, shovels, and all that. And she called for, wanted to know if he had a piece of a stovepipe. And he answered, he said, "Good God, lady, this isn't the hardware." There's hardware hanging all over the place. And he didn't have a stovepipe. And his son went to school with me, Johnny. His sister, Johnny's sister, Florence, she's still alive here in Randolph, and she's a year older than I am, and she's still down to the senior citizens, keeps books and...
Would she be a good person to talk with?
Yeah, yeah. Florence probably could remember and tell you a lot of things that I, because she spent more time there more than I did.
And her name is Florence?
Florence Gould.
G-O-U-L-D?
Yeah. Her husband died quite a few years ago.
But what was her husband's name in case she's listed under?
Stanfield Gould. And so, anyway, Florence Gould, everybody knows her. And then you had a brother, Johnny, who was younger. And one time, I heard this myself. After school, I had to go down to Utah to buy quite a few things because his prices was better than some of the others. And he just had somebody brought in some kind of green apples to be sold there. And Johnny started eating some of them apples. And his father, Warner, name was, he said, because he didn't know some people in there. And he said, "Johnny," he says, "don't eat any more of them apples. You do, you'll have some goddamn gut trouble." Dead people in the store, and I like, but that's the way he was that nervous. And they brought up a boy, I don't know if they adopted him or not, I guess they did, Jasper Moore. His name was Pike, before they had any children, and he was an awful good boy, but he told a good many times Jasper did about his father. His father had horses and run a livery stable, rented out horses to people who rent a horse to go somewhere with. And Jasper had to take care of horses that like. And you know, Warner didn't want him to use so much sawdust. Well, he grumbled about the sawdust. And so down to the mill, the clapboard mill, our Parker's clapboard mill, people used to come in and get two horse loads of horses in a big bot in sawdust for their farm, you know. So they liked Jasper because he's a good boy. He worked hard there. And he had to work like a dickhead and go to school and take care of those horses and that like. And so they used to run their loads over. They'd shovel it and run their loads over. And then after they pulled out, he could scrape up that sawdust. It didn't cost anything. You see, he scraped up what they run over on the ground and take it, and the barn was right there by the mill, and he got his sawdust that way for scraping up. Yeah, oh gosh. Hmm. Yeah, Florence probably could tell you quite a lot of.
And it was her father that ran the store.
Yeah.
That was Warner.
Yeah.
Moore.
And then Bragg's store was another store, little general store, and I like. That store, well, you had some room in there to do something, and they had one of these round stoves, old-fashioned stoves, and they always, a lot of time in the wintertime, not like some of the old-timers used to go in there and sit around that stove and play checkers and tell stories and do things like that. And that was in John Spaulding's store, they didn't have that kind of a place, but it was a bigger store and a nice store, and he had the general store, and John was a very businessman, and he used to buy in the spring a lot of maple syrup and sugar and take it over to Rockford and ship it. And at that time they used to put a lot of they didn't have the call for the syrup, and they used to put it into sugar and put it into wooden tubs. And they'd take it over there and he'd grade it and that like and weigh it up and put it on the train and ship it. He was quite a businessman, a real, real businessman.
Yeah. Well, now, do you remember any of the stories from the rag store?
Well, I remember one story of John. This is true. His wife was very religious, and also she had the Ladies' Aid meet to her place quite a lot. And John lived just through the bridge going toward Lincoln.
This is John Spaulding.
Yeah. And he was a big, tall fellow, and he used to walk. And nowadays, he used to keep a store at Old Evenings. And so he used to walk home for supper, and he had his clerks working and run the store, and he'd walk for exercise and walk home for supper. Well, this particular time, they was having a ladies' aid meeting, and they'd run a little late. He'd come home after supper, and they were still there. And he wasn't too pleased about it, I guess. But and also the minister was there. And their subject, I guess, was somebody had stole something. And they were talking in the other room, and so John was getting his own lunch. And he overheard them. They were telling about, and his wife said to the people and talking to the minister, she says, "I don't see how anybody with a conscience," she says, "could steal anything." And she said, "That is terrible." And she was raving on about it, and he heard it, and some of the ones told about it, so it's a true story. He stepped to the living room door while they all are in the minister, and he says, "Well, that's done." He said, "I stole once." And she said, "Well, John Spaulding, you never did." "Well," he said, "I did." "Well," she said, "I'm ashamed of you." She says, "You never told me. What did you steal?" He said, "I was out with a bunch of ministers, and I stole away from them." They said she was mad enough to kill him. And he grinned and walked away. So that's one of the stories. That's a true fact, too.
That's a great story. Well, I think a lot of the humor came from stories told in the store. And that's another reason, of course, I'm interested in these stories.
And I can tell you another thing that's kind of funny. It seemed funny to me that at the George Bragg store, you had to go up a few steps onto the piazza like grid the store, and there was under the steps were doors to go into the cellar of the store, and they was built up